This is Deep Blue, where we get the true life stories of BYU athletes, coaches, and fans. Here's your host, Jerem Jordan.
On today's show, we talk with the most well-known voice in Cougar sports. He grew up in Canada, attended BYU as a freshman in 1984 of all years. That's awesome. Worked his way through the ranks and now has been calling men's basketball on the radio for the Cougars since 1996 and football since 2001. He enjoys Brooklyn Nine-Nine, Hot Rod and Rush, and probably a lot more than that. He is Greg Rebel, the voice of the Cougars. What's up, Greg?
What's up, Jerem?
How you doing, man?
I'm very well.
Okay, let's talk about you. That's this whole show, actually.
Want to talk about me. Want to talk about I.
Now, one of the joys of my life has been bothering you as a 16-year-old after a basketball game and you being like the nicest guy ever.
No bother.
And then we work together 21 years later, which is super cool.
Flash forward.
You've been amazing.
Not only work together, yeah. I work for you.
I would say with. I'm not going to be producing the coach show anymore with you, which will be a thing that I'll miss. But we've worked together closely the last couple of years. I've been producing the coach show behind the scenes. You host it. That's been awesome.
You've been my boss with the coach's show.
I'm not your boss. I wish I was your boss. One day, you know, never, but whatever. When I was 16 and I bugged you and now we're here, this has been a fun journey. But let's talk about your journey, okay? When you were a kid, did you think, yeah, I want to move to the States and call basketball and football? Like, when did this whole thing start with you?
Now, the move to the States part was never part of the equation. But there came a point, I think, during my high school days where I realized that if I could talk for a living, I might like to explore that. There was a long time when architect was the objective. I was going to be an architect.
Why was that?
I just really thought design and construction was fascinating, and I wanted to be a part of it. I just had in my mind that it'd be great to be involved in that side of a profession. And so I took drafting classes in high school, but it just didn't click for me. There was something missing. I struggled with too many basics and too many fundamentals to know that this would be the thing for me. It became too unnatural for me to pick up all the things I felt I would need to be a really good architect. And so I was kind of dissuaded from pursuing that and persuaded more toward the creative or the public speaking side of things. And so once I made that decision, I found myself more involved in things that put me either on stage or in front of a microphone or performing in one way or another.
How old are you at this point when you kind of figured this 12 out?
12 to 14, okay. 15, yeah. So public speaking contests, choir.
Wait, hold on. What's a public speaking contest?
There was an organization up where I lived in Canada that basically held contests for young people to present, orations on whatever topic you've been assigned, and it's basically a public speaking contest.
Nice.
Or competitions.
That's great.
So I was engaged in those, got involved in choir, drama.
Tenor, bass, baritone?
I was a tenor.
Nice. Are you still a tenor?
I think I'm a solid baritone now.
Nice.
Yeah, I can still get tenor content, but I'm more of a baritone.
Nice.
I mean, I can pretend I'm a bass sometimes.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
For the most part.
All tenors do. I can relate
to
that.
Yeah, yeah. So choir. I was in band for a while.
What
is drama, clarinet and bass clarinet.
Ooh, nice.
So, and then in drama, theater. So I was in plays, and there was also in singing competitions.
Apart
from choir. So
you went after it.
I was just doing things that put you in a position to put yourself out there, not really knowing exactly where I would go yet. I just kind of felt the more comfortable I could get in the public forum, the better. So it was all good training for me. And then there was kind of a side component of it that I thought was, in hindsight, in retrospect, was inspiring me more than I knew at the time. And that is, my dad was the public address announcer for the hockey team in town where I grew up, which was Saskatoon in Saskatchewan. And so he was the PA announcer for the Saskatoon Blades. And so his perch was in a press box suspended over the ice at the old Saskatoon Arena, and he had his little announcer booth. And when he'd take me to games, I'd be in the booth with him. And so
the seed is planted.
Yeah, because he would, he had the microphone, the on-off switch, and he hits the button, and all of a sudden his voice is reverberating out in this arena, and it got me used to the notion of the power of a microphone, how you can captivate an audience. And my dad had a great voice, and I just thought it was the coolest thing. My dad, you know, talk to the crowd, and they could, and they were waiting for his words.
A literal reaction and feedback.
Yeah, when a goal was scored, there's the reaction of the crowd. Then comes the announcement from my dad. You know, goal scored by so and so, assist to so and so, and then the crowd reacts again. And you know, typical announcements and the drive home safely, and everything was just my dad talking to the crowd and controlling the crowd with the microphone in a way. I was really kind of fascinated by that, the power of a microphone. And so as I got, you know, 12, 13, 14, began thinking more about career and what interested me, while I was putting myself in performing spaces, I loved all sports. I loved reading about sports. I loved the stats of sports, the trivia. I loved listening and watching. Listening to and watching sports. In Canada, Saturday nights were all about hockey night in Canada. Well, back it up a little bit. At 6
Is
o'clock.
It every night, hockey night in Canada?
But Saturday night, when you have three channels or two channels, really, CBC and CTV, yeah. You know, Saturday night with so few offerings, it was hockey night in Canada. Saturday night on CBC. So 6 o'clock was hockey night in Canada, but at 5 o'clock, curling came on. And so it
now
was
we're talking.
Yeah, it was always 5 o'clock curling, 6 o'clock hockey. And when the hockey would come on, you're talking about the broadcasting duo of Danny Gallivan and Dick Irvin. And they ran Hockey Night in Canada for, you know, 20, 30 years as the broadcast duo. So those are the voices I listened to. So I had weekly routines, and Don Chevrier was the voice of curling. And so I had these weekly routines that were focused on broadcasters coming into my home and being with them every week. And when once we got American cable in Canada, now you're talking about the NBC baseball game of the week, and now it's Joe Garagiola and it's Bob Costas, and these things are kind of just still building with you. And so I became really accustomed to the routine focused on broadcasts and broadcasters. And so all this kind of comes together and jumbles in, and I realize, man, I love sports, and man, I love trivia, man, I love numbers, and gosh, I'm really fascinated by broadcasters and broadcasting, and all that kind of galvanized. And then I found myself, you know, arranging tours of radio stations and TV stations and writing letters to broadcasters and just kind of now letting it all percolate to, you know, how can I do what they do? And then we kind of went from there.
Okay. Follow-up questions. What plays were you in?
The one I had the most fun with and still kept a program from was Anne of Green Gables. I was Gilbert Blythe.
You were Anne.
I was not Anne. I was Anne's love interest. I was Gilbert Blythe in Anne of Green Gables. So as a senior in high school, that was kind of the pinnacle for me was getting into that.
You mentioned your dad as a PA, and that's a real big one where it's like, okay, you could combine those two things in some way, right? You figure that out. That's awesome.
Yeah.
You've done some public address announcing, didn't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, no, it came around full circle. So when I was working at KSL back in my early days, I became a non-paid intern for Mark Kelly at the Salt Lake Golden Eagles. I would just kind of, you know, I'd finish my shift and I'd run over to the Salt Palace and run stats and do whatever he needed. So I kind of hung around for a season back in 1990, 91, somewhere around there. I'd just gotten married, just wanting to do anything. I was working at KSL, which was great, but I loved hockey and the hockey team was there, and Mark Kelly with the Golden Eagles was just awesome to me and kept me around and kept me busy. And then Mike Runge, who was a Fox 13 anchor at the time, kind of a, you know, for those a little more old school, Mike was like a big name in local sports along with PJ and guys like that. And Mike Runge.
Paul James, for those who know.
Right,
that.
Right. And we'll talk more about him. But yeah. Mike Runge was also doing PA for the Golden Eagles at the time. He got busier with Fox 13, had to quit the Golden Eagles PA job. And even though I was young and didn't have a lot of developed talents yet, Mark Kelly said, well, I got this kid here. He'll work cheap. And he likes this kind of thing. His dad was a PA announcer, so we're gonna take this full circle. So I got to actually for a few seasons be the public address announcer.
A few seasons?
Yeah.
Whoa.
It was a couple
That's
three
awesome.
Four seasons. Yeah, I was for the Salt Lake Golden Eagles back when we were playing at the Delta back then the Delta Center.
Is that at the top of your LinkedIn or where is that?
It doesn't exist on my LinkedIn. Do I even have
do
a LinkedIn?
Do you even have a
yeah,
LinkedIn?
So
I think you need one.
I haven't been job searching for a while. So the public address thing. This is right as they moved from the Salt Palace to the new Delta Center. So I got to be in the new building. And, hey, I got to wear the red IHL sweater. I was an official IHL-like personnel type guy. So I was it's great because the announcing booth was actually at ice level between the two penalty boxes.
Oh, you weren't up high.
No. So I was actually down between the two penalty boxes in the Delta Center back in the day of the Delta Center. And so that was the best thing, too, was announcing, but from ice level, where you get a totally different feel for the game when you're that close. And then the great thing is, too, when you get guys to come in who just had a scrap, you know, two guys that come in and each got five for fighting, you get to be a part or be between their conversations when they come in the box. And that's the other great thing about it. Sometimes they'd still be pretty upset with each other. Yeah. And you'd have to, you know, kind of be aware of what's flying, what, you know, what direction. But a lot of times, as it is with hockey, these guys are just doing their jobs. They respect each other. They get in and they kind of, you know, it's small talk at that point in the penalty box between the two fighters.
How's Mary? She's great.
Either way, it was a ton of fun seeing guys that were on their way up to the NHL or had been in the league for a while and coming back down and still, you know, cashing a check. So there were a lot of great names and a lot of great experiences just being a PA announcer for the Salt Lake Golden Eagles. And I don't talk enough about Mark Kelly, but Mark Kelly was a big part of my early career that way, just getting me in the booth and getting me involved with a team. And there was a time when I tried to when I thought about leaving broadcasting for a job with the team. I actually didn't get it. And this is when the Golden Eagles, I think it was close to their transition time to becoming the Grizzlies, but they were still the Golden Eagles at the time, as I recall. And I actually applied for a job, would have been a step up from PA, obviously, and didn't get it. So I stayed where I was.
Which job?
It was a public relations job, I think, with the team. And then within a couple seasons, the team was gone. And so, you know, blessing in disguise kind of thing, but I didn't get that job. And this is, again, early in my career. I was still feeling my way as a broadcaster. I wasn't yet in sports. I was doing a lot more news.
At KSL.
At KSL. Because my first sports gig, KSL hired me in 89. I didn't end up on the football crew as the sideline guy till 92. So for the first 2-3 years, I was working news. And that's another, you know, lesson that I share with people that want to know about it is that, you know, don't hold out for your dream job. It might not be readily available. Do the job that you're given and do the best at it. The old act, you know, whatever thou art, act well thy part. That kind of served me well. Because I was working news for 2-3 years before I actually got my first sports opportunity at KSL. But it was during those early years when I was really itching for something in sports. And so it was the hockey gig I tried for. I actually tried for a job at BYU in public relations. I didn't get that. I still have the rejection letter from Val Hale in my desk. I didn't get that one either.
Great.
So there were a couple opportunities that I was pursuing because I wanted sports so badly, right?
Yes.
And I tried to get involved with the team. I tried to get involved with BYU. I wasn't qualified enough yet for either. So it kept me where I was, but by staying where I was, ultimately the door opened to get me into the sports side of things and the BYU side of things at KSL, and the rest is history.
Man, that's wild. Okay, this is why we do this show, so we can learn things about you. I didn't know a ton of this. I love this.
That's why I'm here, Jeremy.
I love being able to chat about these things. Okay, you mentioned you love sports growing up. Obviously, you love hockey. You like curling. What else do you like at this point?
I mean, the curling thing, I don't see a lot of it nowadays, but it was, I mean, my dad was a curler, okay?
What do you mean he was a curler? He played recreationally?
He was on a recreational team.
Okay.
A rink of guys, and they competed. He would leave town on the weekends with his boys.
Traveling.
They would drive to other cities and compete in what are called Bonspiels. A curling tournament's called a Bonspiel.
A Bonspiel.
A Bonspiel.
B-O-N-S-P-I-E-L,
Bonspiel.
Oh, don't ask me to spell it.
They would go compete in Bonspiels, all right? They play a weekend of curling. And
there would be Glockenspiels at the Bonspiels.
Can't speak to that. But at the Bonspiel, you compete. You go in the tournament. If you're any good, you win stuff. You come home with prizes. Sometimes you win cash. But we had so many appliances in our house that were a result of my dad's Bonspiel winnings.
Why do you have three ovens?
Come home with a toaster. Come home with a record player. These were the prizes. You get money or you get prizes at these things. And so,
did you have your own record player then, growing up?
We did have a phonograph. Yeah, we had a record player. No, we did. And in fact, just if we flash forward, my daughter for her most recent birthday. Gave a record player and some vinyl.
Look at you.
Because kids today, they don't know about the vinyl.
What vinyl did you give her?
I gave her 5 Beatles albums.
Look at you.
She's been big into the Beatles. And so I started off with kind of 5 of what I think are the best Beatles albums. And so she has – anyway, long story short, that takes us forward.
That's amazing.
But yeah, no, we had a record player. And one of the albums I gave my daughter a couple months ago for her 16th birthday was the first album I recall listening to as a kid, which was Revolver from the Beatles. Mm. My parents had that, along with a ton of other stuff. But yeah, record players were big. But a lot of the stuff, my point is, a lot of stuff we had in our house were things my dad actually won as a curler. And so our house was full of curling brooms and shoe covers and heavy sweaters and patches from tournaments. And so curling was – and on Saturdays when they were home, I would go with my dad to the rink. And, you know, it's smoke and it's beer and it's just this vibe of of, you know, the curlers at the time, how they lived their lives, and it was just a great wild place to be. You know, they'd put the kids in the cafe area with the wives and the moms and everyone else, and the guys would be out on the rink curling, and we'd watch through the windows. And so I spent so many Saturdays as a kid in the wintertime at the curling rink watching my dad do his thing. And so curling was big, and of course I loved watching it. And in fact, it was a class I took in high school. I had a curling class in high school.
That's awesome.
As part of PE, which is a lot of fun. So that, and of course hockey, I played it. You know, everyone plays, right? And I played every winter until I was, you know, 12, 13, 14, and became not as good as I needed to be to stay highly competitive. But I loved playing and, of course, watching hockey. And so curling and hockey were big, but I had interest in baseball. I played Little League baseball. American baseball was big. And then the Blue Jays and Expos were the huge part of my life because those were Canada's teams at that point. Mm-hmm. And so baseball was big. I never really got into American football or basketball until I, you know, really, you know, we'd watch NBA, but, you know, back in the early 80s, you weren't getting live NBA. So those were things that I came into later. But hockey and baseball were big for me. And, of course, Canadian football. The Saskatchewan Rough Riders, where I grew up, were my team until we moved to Calgary. Then the Calgary Stampeders were my team, and we had tickets. And so I loved CFL and you know, much later to American football than Canadian, obviously.
So obviously you're growing up in Canada. You come to the United States later. How does Canada still sort of resonate in who you are and what you do even to this day?
Well, I've lived longer in the States than I ever did in Canada now, right? You know, probably twice as long as
I have.
Is that
weird for you?
It's a little weird because, you know, in your heart and in your mind, you think of yourself as the product of your upbringing because you think of yourself as, in my case, Canadian. But I've lived far more years as an American and a naturalized American now than I have or did as a Canadian living up there. But it's a true thing. You know, the first 16 years, I graduated high school when I was 16. So from
16?
Yeah, I was a little bit young. They skipped me a grade when I was younger.
Your birthday is in late August. So
right.
Just, yeah.
And they skipped me a grade. And so I ended up being, I was always the youngest and shortest kid in my class growing up because I was bumped up a year, right?
Yeah.
So I was young. So I graduated at 16. So mm-hmm. Let's say from birth to 16 years old, those are my formative years, right? My Canadian years. Those 16 years in my mind felt a lot longer than anything that's come since, if that makes sense. Because when we're younger, the passage of time is so much slower in our brains because every year is a larger percentage of our time on the earth until we get older. You know, so for a 10-year-old,
I've never thought about
For a 10-year-old, you know, the year from your 9th birthday to your 10th birthday, that's a tenth of your life.
Yes.
That's 10% of your life. You know, 10% of your life as a 50-year-old is 5 years. So, you know, relatively speaking,
yes,
for a 10-year-old, you know, a year encompasses the amount of time like that 5 years might encompass for someone much older in terms of in their mind how
yes
long time is. So my childhood years seem to have lasted forever. And so I think a lot about my Canadian years because they seem to last forever. Just from a perception standpoint. But all that said, yeah, there's part of my heart that just kind of, you know, you see the anthem, you hear the anthem, you see the flag, you watch the flames, you watch Canada's Olympic teams, and you have that natural affection. Even though America's been my home, it's provided my livelihood, all my kids have been born here, I have fewer ties to Canada than I do to the U.S., and I am a naturalized citizen, too. America's a big part of my identity now, but Canada will never leave me by the same token.
Did you have to take a test to naturalize?
Uh-huh.
Was it hard?
Oh, yes. They nailed it. But you study. You need to study.
My mom took this test from Mexico when she was 14, and she said it was super hard because she didn't know any U.S. history.
Right. And you know, coming to BYU, well, first of all, you take the ACT, and you already kind of feel like the ACT is kind of slanted, you know, this way. I felt like I had to study extra hard for the ACT because of where I was living.
Yeah.
And then you come down, and you're taking American Heritage, and these are new things for you at this point. You're having to really catch up. I mean, granted, I think we in Canada kind of pride ourselves on being, you know, citizens of the world and kind of knowing more about more things, perhaps.
Yeah.
I think our perception up there was that you know, U.S. citizens are much more centralized, that they focus much more on their own border, right, and what's within their own borders than Canada. We kind of prided ourselves on knowing more about the states than the states knew about us, if that makes any sense.
That is for sure.
Yeah. So when I came to BYU, it wasn't like I was just, was stumbling around in the dark. I felt like I had a pretty good grip on
what
America
English.
Was about. I spoke a different brand of English, and I lost my accent over time. But,
it was the whole
oat and the boat and sorry and yep. all those things.
Once a show... I felt like it came out on Satake or something. I was like, oh, he said a boot.
Yeah.
Or whatever. I could barely hear it.
But I was kind of a novelty to my classmates at BYU my first year or two because they say,
like,
this,
say this.
Say this. Say that. Yeah. And yeah, I lost it over time. But yeah.
When did you lose it? Post college or something?
Yeah, it was probably sometime late in college. Or your mission also takes a little bit out of you. When you go speak a different language for 2 years, it also gives you an entirely different feel for cadence and rhythm and accents and things. And then when I got back on my mission, I wasn't home for too long before I was right back at school. So, really my hardcore Canadian existence kind of ended after high school. Because once I came to BYU, I was only going home for Christmas and summers. And then I got...
Stampede, right?
We just had that. They just had it this past month. Well, earlier this month. The Stampede's a great time in Calgary.
If you're ever going to go there, that's when you want to go.
Free pancake breakfast on every corner downtown. It's a fun time to be there. But once I came down to BYU, I was married... while I was still in school, and then KSL hired me while I was still in school. So when I graduated from BYU, I was already – I already had my life set up. I was already married. I already had a job, full-time job. And so I had no real – I had nothing pulling me back to Canada. I had no reason to go back home. So this was going to be my new home now as long as I stayed employed.
Okay, so you come to BYU as a 16-year-old.
I just turned – I turned 17 first week of class as a freshman.
Okay, so you're 17.
Yeah.
What's that like? You're super young. You're in another country.
Yeah, no, it was hard.
Now you're at BYU.
Yeah, it was. I still remember.
This is 84?
This is 84.
What
fall of 84.
A fall so, to yeah, well, show yeah, up here.
So August 26th, 1984, I turned 17 while I'm already down here because school's going to start like the next Monday, I think, something like that. So I was down here for my 17th birthday of my freshman year. So just turned 17. Parents came down. I still remember we stayed at the Colony Inn on University Avenue, which is no longer the Colony Inn, but the building is still there. It's still a rundown, like motel-looking building now, and it's still there. That was where we stayed, at the Colony Inn on University Avenue, to get me to school in the fall of 84.
And a raucous birthday party.
Just a kid, still 17. Relatively speaking. And I remember I stayed at Deseret Towers. The dear departed Deseret Towers. The ones that are there now are not the ones I recognize. Okay? The old dorm. The old DT is
– yeah. Oh, crazy story.
But Q Hall. I stayed in Q Hall. So my parents dropped me off at Q Hall, got unpacked. I still didn't have my roommate yet. So it's just me by myself in this dorm room. And I watched them drive away. And I'd never felt more alone and borderline – not afraid, but just a fish out of water. University, different country – folks are gone. Very few – I had some friends from Calgary that came down to go, but they weren't my roommate or anything. So just kind of on my own. And I remember just sitting in the dorm room just kind of wondering what this is going to be all about, And it's a Saturday, as I recall, when they left. And it's the day BYU plays Pitt in the first ESPN televised college football game, right? Yeah. So it's BYU's season opener of the mythical 1984 season. And I'm in my dorm room, still waiting for a roommate, just kind of looking around, and I'm still not clued into the whole college life thing yet. And the Pitt BYU game, I believe, happens before classes actually began. I think it was the Saturday before the Monday that classes began, I think, at BYU. And so I'm in the dorm room, and I'm noticing people start filing past Q Hall, like lines of people. And I'm what's happening? Where are they going? What's going on? They're all walking toward the Marriott Center, which is just a few hundred yards down the road. And so I just go down to the lobby and walk out and start joining the line and just started following the crowd. And what they were doing was going into the Marriott Center. BYU'd set up a big screen in the Marriott Center for fans to walk into the building and watch the BYU Pitt game on ESPN, because ESPN was a new enough thing at that time that not everyone had ESPN, right? That was kind of a rare thing.
Yeah.
But they had it set up at the Marriott Center to be on a big screen. And so
like
I walked
on the floor because they don't have a jumbotron.
Yeah, it was suspended from the ceiling. So the screens were stretched down to the floor from speakers or whatnot, the old scoreboard. And so they had a big screen set up, and I just wandered into the Marriott Center took a seat by myself with the other BYU fans, and that was my introduction to BYU football.
Was That's watching the intro, BYU number three Pitt.
Yeah, watching BYU at Pitt. And it was an early-ish game. It felt like it started 10, 11, 12 o'clock Provo time. And that was my introduction to life at BYU, Cougar football, Robbie Bosco, all these things. By the time I had a class with Glenn Kozlowski, I was like, this is insane. I'm in a class with Glenn Kozlowski.
Well, Glenn is insane.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, getting to know him over time. And but that was just – that was my introduction to all those names, yeah. Adam Haysbert and all these it all just kind of came through on that one day. And then I was in it, you know.
So. What a day to just drop in. Okay, so do you go a year? Do you go 2 years and then you go on a mission?
Yeah, since I was young, I got 2 years in.
You got 2 years
in. And, you know –
we call that a Russ Chalavea. That's what he – and Ian Doulon.
Okay.
They both went two.
I got two, and then I left. And
I think
and
Russ might have gone three and then come back.
And so at the same time, you know, as soon as I got to campus, one of the first things I did was wander down to the old KBYU newsroom in the HVAC, the Fine Arts Center. And in the tunnel of the HVAC was where the KBYU TV newsroom was. And I wandered in there. I met the news director and said, hey, I'm a freshman. I want to be a broadcaster. I want to be a sportscaster.
You did this?
It was like first week.
Oh,
first
for
days.
You. I didn't even know where to go.
Oh, no. I you know, again, it's a 17-year-old kid, wanders in, corners the news director and says, I'm Greg Grubel. I want to be a sportscaster. What do you think? And he was like, oh, okay. I admire your spunk, young bucko.
No, where's that accent from? Austria?
So he essentially said, okay, I hear you. You know, he said, I get so many people that want to be sportscasters. That's kind of the thing. And he said, why don't you do this? Why don't you go find a BYU team no one knows about and do a story on them? I go, do a story on them? He said, yeah, I'll give you a photographer. I'll give you an editor. And just go see what you can do.
This what is,
again,
in the world?
I haven't had any classes yet. I had no background.
Yeah.
Other than the fact that I said, you know, I want to be a broadcaster. I had some public speaking, blah, blah, blah. He said, but for whatever reason, his name was Bill Silcock, by the way,
okay.
Dr. Bill Silcock, who just retired from a teaching position and with the Cronkite School at Arizona State.
ASU,
he's been there a long time.
That's
since
a
he
legit
left. Oh, yeah. No, he was a big time there and he was forever here. Mm. So Bill Silcock, bless his heart, kind of gave me my first break, if you will, and said, go, I'll give you a photographer, I'll give you an editor, go do a story.
That's unbelievable.
And so what I did was I found the extramural fencing team, club team.
Okay.
BYU had a fencing club or a fencing team,
yeah,
whatever you want to call it. And I went and spent a couple days with the fencers. They'd have their practices at the RB, and I did a story on the fencing club. Okay. And within a few days, it was on TV. So
wow.
that started it. And then, of course,
on
I began. Exactly. They had the student run news program,
yep.
Utah News Tonight, it was called back in the day, UNT, Utah News Tonight. And so it'd be on Channel 11. And so it got on there. And then, of course, then I started getting into my classes. But I was brought along early, and they kind of accelerated my development by saying, go get them, you know? And so for those first 2 years, I had done all the, you know, writing and reporting and anchoring and producing I could possibly fit into for those first 2 years before my mission. One of the biggest challenges for me was, as part of my development, I would do some reporting and anchoring on the FM station, KBYU FM, Classical 89. They'd have news at the top and the bottom of the hour, and they'd have the student-run newscasts. And I'd get put in charge of that. But my delivery did not jive with the FM managers or the audience.
How so?
I was just way too fast, way too rapid, way too high energy.
On a classical station?
Right.
Yes.
And so I was yanked. I was told he doesn't go back on the air until he's a lot slower and easier to understand. So that was an issue early on. And it was a good lesson too. I mean, I needed to change my delivery style. And as you can tell as we're talking, it's always been that way. Little frenetic, little fast-paced, little energetic, little
it
type
works
A.
It for sports.
Right. It's great for play-by-play and sports talk and those kinds of things. But FM news wasn't quite the fit, and so I needed to do some work on that. And so as rapidly as I speak now, back in the day, way back in the day, it was much more of a problem and something I really had to work on. I was much less intelligible, and I've learned over time, hopefully at least, that I've kept speed and pace – but still, enhanced it with the ability to enunciate and be easily understood.
I think that should go on your LinkedIn as well. Former Class 89 news guy.
Short-lived.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so you go on your mission. This is where I have a random fun connection with you. Not only did we both go to Brazil, and where do you go again? You go to Sao Paulo North?
Sao Paulo Norte.
Sao Paulo Norte. So how was that? How was Sao Paulo Norte in 86 to 88?
Yeah, I got there Christmas week of 86.
Christmas week?
Yeah.
Like what day?
Like 23rd.
I got there the 27th.
Yeah, so I got there right before Christmas.
Time.
And
yeah.
And of course, when you go there at that time, it's the middle of summer, not winter.
Yep.
And it's nothing but nonstop rain. And it's just rain, rain, rain. And that's at least what I walked into was a week of rain. At Christmas time when you're missing your family and you're alone and you're scared and you can't speak. And it was
You're alone and you're scared again.
Yeah.
In another country.
Yeah, that'll be the title of my book, Greg Wrubell, Alone and Scared.
Yeah. But fully clothed. Yeah.
Getting there was hard. It was a tough time to be there, to be kind of homesick, to have it be Christmas time, to have the weather be what it was and just not feel like you could speak or converse or communicate. So you say, how was it? Well, the first month or two, not great.
Yeah.
And then things get better. It always gets better. And I found that it got better once you stop Xing days off the calendar. That was big for me.
Like you're on an island by yourself or something. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so I went on my mission to the southern part of Brazil in Porto Alegre, the north mission, and I am at lunch. So I meet you when I'm 16, and as I mentioned, and I say, what did you do at BYU, and what do I get into? You let me go on Sports Night with Greg Wrubell, a radio show you have.
I had a talk show back on KSL back
then.
Yeah,
you had a talk show. Who knew? And so we get to know each other, and you're super nice and awesome, and you invite me to the studio, and it's amazing. Maybe we'll talk about that later. The point is, I've established a relationship with you because I want to be the next you when you're done, right? And that's still to this day when you're done in 10, 20 years, whatever. But I know you, and I go on my mission, and I'm like, oh, I know that Greg Wrubell went to Brazil. I'm at lunch. And
members' house?
Yes. That's what you do in Brazil. You don't go to dinner. You go to lunch with members.
Almost.
Dinner, we just didn't even eat. It was,
yeah.
But
anyway. You're on the road. You get something from
so
a cafe.
So busy, yeah. So I'm talking to, you know, the husband. I'm like, oh, where did you go on your mission? He's like, Sao Paulo North. And I was like, oh, that's cool. I'm flipping through this book, and boom, I see a picture of you as a missionary. And I'm in Brazil, and I'm like, this is awesome. Full head of hair, the whole deal, man.
It's probably our mission directory. We had a little book, right? Yeah.
And I was like, oh, my gosh.
Yeah, full head of hair. Important to note that.
I can't wait to tell Greg in however long I have until I get home. But that was super fun and random. Yeah. And Brazil is an amazing country.
Yeah, we do share that link, having both served down there. Yeah.
Yeah, it's awesome. Okay, so you go to Brazil. You come back. Mm-hmm. And are you like a returning starter in broadcasting,
weird thing is because I'd gotten so much in, at least in my mind at the time, I felt I'd gotten so much in the first 2 years. And I was so entrenched in the broadcast program. You know, how can I leave this? I could go pro now. You know, this whole thing is like, I declare early. No, it's like I was so into broadcasting at the time. I was like, oh, I'm going to break for 2 years. Am I gonna lose it? You know, am I going to lose it and lose my connection? And when I came back, it was a different feel altogether. New group of students, you know, some new professors. And it just felt like I was starting all over again. I wasn't, but in my mind, I was like, wow, this feels like I'm back to square one. But yeah, within a few months, you're back in doing the things you loved doing, and you're getting more and more experience to the point where when I was a junior, so my first year back off the mission, that's when Chris Tunis, the KSL radio sports director, and for those who don't know the name Chris Tunis, he was Utah's sports talk pioneer, if you will. Before the genre was a genre, before sports talk was a thing nationally, KSL gave Chris his own sports talk show at night. Sports Central, and you know, it was a new thing at the time, sports talk radio. And so Chris Tunis, as the sports director at KSL, had this show, and he felt he needed some help in the office, and he posted for an internship. It was his first ever internship. And so I'm in the tunnel at the Harris Fine Arts Center where the newsroom was, and I see on the posting board, the cork board, a KSL radio's posting for a sports intern. I'm like, this would be great. This is right up my alley. And I applied for it, and I got it. And that got me in the door at Broadcast House, got me in the door at KSL, working with the legendary Chris Tunis. And like I'm like literally cutting his newspaper clippings and taping them to paper and splicing audio tape and doing all the grunt work that you do as
anyone
a non-paid
under
30 intern.
Doesn't understand
any of that.
What you just
but those
said.
Are the things that I would do on a daily basis to help Chris Tunis get his sports talk show ready every day and get his sports cast ready. And so I was now in a professional broadcast environment. KBYU is awesome, and what they do with college students and the equipment we have and have had forever since, the entire BYU broadcasting program is amazing. But now I'm in a professional shop, and I'm learning the business with Chris Tunis and meeting Craig Bowlerjack and Steve Cyphers and all these guys that are just, you know, the names in sports, and of course Paul James, who's both a KSL TV and radio legend at this point. But I'm in that building now, and I'm getting that feel and that vibe as a non-paid intern in the spring of 1989. And it's funny because the interns that I have working with me now, they're not paid. It's for credit. And there are those who say, oh, you know, interns all need to get paid. They all, you know, no, there should be no for-credit internships. And I was from the school that said, it's about the experience and the networking and the connection and the education more than it is a check. For that matter, I was going to school in Provo. The internship's in Salt Lake. I had no car. I was taking UTA. So I was paying for the internship to get myself to and from Salt Lake. I was the one just to get in the building, right, and just to have the experience. So I think it's okay to not be paid as an intern. That's your time to learn and grow as a student. You'll get paid eventually. That's what this is all about.
Yeah.
But that's the way I did it. I respect all those who work with me who do it for credit, because I think the valuable thing are the things I mentioned. But that was my experience, was coming up to work with Chris Tunis for those few months in the spring, and by doing that, that then planted the seed in the manager's minds, because once the internship ended, I went back to Canada. I got married soon thereafter, and I'm back at school. I'm back at BYU now as a married student. No job, but I'm working at KBYU, doing the stuff there, getting paid a little bit there. But I'd planted the seed as an intern to where the news director contacted me and said, hey, Greg, we liked what you did as an intern for Chris. He speaks well of you. We have an opening for a weekend radio news anchor reporter. Do you want to try out for it? Do you want to apply for it? And I said, yes. I cut a tape. I applied, interviewed, and I got the job. Okay, I wanted to be a sportscaster. Here's a news job being offered me. Do I say no thanks, but no thanks, or do I take it and do my very best? Well, obviously the answer is I took it, did my very best, and a few news jobs over time then turned into a sports job, which turned into the sideline gig, which turned into the play-by-play gig, and turned into a talk show gig, and on we go. But it all started with that non-paid internship, grinding as hard as I could through that, hopefully leaving a good impression, and then not closing the door to a news job, but saying, I'll do whatever you need me to do. And I learned a lot as a one-man show. I mean, when Saturday Sunday came along at KSL Radio, I was it. I was the reporter. I was the anchor. I was covering it all myself. And I learned a ton by working those 2 days a week. Those were jam-packed days, because I go to school Monday to Friday, then work Saturday, Sunday at KSL, and then right back into it. It was a seven-day-a-week thing for a long time. And then the first full-time gig KSL offered me was overnights, weeknights, 10 p.m. to 6 a.m., while I was still in school. So I'd go to school in the morning and early afternoon and then work all night at KSL.
I was doing
graveyards, exactly. I had a few hours between like 4 and 7 at night when I would sleep.
Oh, my.
So, and that was my last semester at BYU. I was a senior at BYU working full time at KSL, trying to stay awake in class while working graveyards.
And married.
Wow. And working graveyards, news job. Again, I was the overnight news anchor and reporter for KSL Radio. So I'd record the Larry King show, play back Larry King. I learned a lot about Larry King and his guests. Believe me, he was like a hero to mine for my job. And then I was working the overnights. And then at 6 in the morning, the shift would end. I'd run from broadcast house to Temple Square, get on a bus, get on the UTA, take the bus down. Hey, I married into a car. I never had a car until I got married. I would take the bus to Provo, sleep on the bus, wake up as it hit Zions Bank by Provo High School, wake up, go to class, finish class, get on the bus, go back to Salt Lake, sleep, work, and repeat.
Wow.
And those were the early years, right? But you need those. I embrace those. I cherish those years. Once graduation came, I was already a full-time employee. And again, positions opened up as I went along. But man, that was a wild time, but I needed it.
That's insane, man. Okay, so you graduate, you get the job. You don't get the job with the Eagles, but you're the PA and all that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so at what point do you finally get into sports?
A reporter, a news reporter named Jim Braden at KSL Radio, he'd be a news reporter for most of the day, but he'd do morning sports for a little sliver of the day. And he was also the sideline reporter for the BYU games on the weekend with Paul James and Mark Lyons. He replaced Doug Miller. So Doug Miller was replaced by Jim Braden. Jim Braden's now the new sideline reporter for the football games on BYU Radio. I mean, on KSL Radio, beg your pardon. And he would also do morning sports at KSL.
What year is this?
This is 1991, 92. Okay, so in the spring of 92, Jim Braden gets another job, gets a job with Salt Lake County, and he leaves KSL. Well, his job was morning sports and football sidelines. Now, that job is open, okay? So after 3 years of toiling away in news, I see an opening. And I apply for it, I get it, and now I am doing sports. I was also producing for the Doug Wright Show. So to make it a full-time job, I had to do more than just the morning sports. I had to do the morning sports and then produce for Doug Wright and then do the sidelines on top of that. So all that became a full-time job. And so a little bit of news / Doug Wright. And Doug Wright's amazing. I mean, people, again, Doug yes, Wright, talk show legend.
Incredible.
And for a little while in my career, I produced for him. Honor.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's so awesome. I was his producer. I wasn't very good. But that was my job.
You're like, please take the sports show.
But morning sports anchor, produce for Doug Wright, and then sidelines on the weekends with football. Mm. And so as a part of that, I'd be down at BYU now during the week getting interviews, watching practice. I was in the BYU picture now, finally. That's 1992, so this will be my 30th season. So when the season kicks off here in September, this will kick off my 30th season on the crew. The first one being 1992 as the sideline guy replacing Jim Braden. My first ever game at UTEP, John Walsh's first game after Ty Detmer graduated. And I remember everything about that weekend, the way the ground looked as the plane landed in El Paso, to the smoke in the parking lot from the barbecue, to everything about that weekend. Hmm. That was my BYU football broadcast debut with Paul James and Mark Lyons as his new sideline guy at UTEP in 1992. This will be my 30th season since that first game against UTEP back then. And I remember being so ambitious, and I wanted to give Paul James absolutely everything a sideline guy could give him. I shoehorned myself into every part of that broadcast. Bless Paul James, because I wanted to be on every 30 seconds with something. You know, I said, I've got you this, I've got you that. I'd be in the stands talking to John Walsh's parents, interviewing them live. I was doing every possible thing I could to give flavor to his broadcast. I think after that first broadcast, we said a little bit less is more probably here. But I still remember just wanting to give Paul James as much as I possibly could so he'd think I was good at what I was doing. Yeah.
You haven't lost that sort of vigor to prepare and execute well, though. That same idea. Obviously, you know, like, how much is good.
Right.
From doing this for 30 years, this being the sports specifically. But, oh, my gosh.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to be as good as I could possibly be for him. And I'm exaggerating. I wasn't on every 30 seconds. But I wanted to give him the option to come to me for whatever he needed.
Yes.
I set him up with every possible scenario to, you know, if you need flavor for this or that, I'm here. I got you.
Yes.
You know, and that was always my motivation was be good for Paul.
Yes.
Because the one thing more than anything I learned from traveling with and watching Paul James work was just how much prep went into game night and game day, how much he cared, how much it mattered to him. As long as he'd been doing it, you know, he would still – it was legal pad, write things out word for word. I mean, his pregame show was scripted. You know, I'd watch him script it on a legal pad in his hotel room word for word with a pen. And then he'd read it word for word. But I'm like, the way you deliver it, it's like no one would ever know you're reading it. No one would ever know that's scripted because that's just so natural.
Yeah.
So I learned everything. Everything I still do today, I learned from Paul in those nights watching him work. And granted, I did legal pad too until we had computers and got to do it, you know, with word processing
Thank
programs.
Goodness.
But it was all legal pads and Sharpies and handwritten everything because I watched him handwrite his boards and handwrite his scripts. And so I did that exactly how Paul did it. But the preparation component and the hours he put into it and not shortcutting anywhere, I adopted hopefully all of that into what I tried to do, you know, when I had the same opportunity.
I have been highly influenced by you, obviously. I would say the most influential broadcaster on my play-by-play career at the different other levels, you know, not football and basketball, but like to the board you do, to the amount of prep, to the da-da-da. At some point I realized, okay, I can probably wing it pretty well, but I'm going to be as good as I am prepared. Like I will be no better than that. So I really appreciate that from you from over the years of letting me look at the boards you use. For those who don't know, play-by-plays, you don't just show up and call a game. You create a board if you want. has different info that you want to relay. Teams make what are called game notes, although it's sort of going away for a lot of teams.
And we have our own game note. We also produce our own game notes in a lot of instances.
Other
too.
Nuggets and personality-based things or whatever that we want to inject at the right time. And there are like nuances to this, right, of radio and TV and when you insert yourself, when you don't. But you've been totally influential on me in that way where, oh, I want to be the most prepared person relative to this broadcast on the planet. Like if I'm calling this game, I got to be the smartest guy in the room because I'm the play-by-play.
Yeah.
The analyst breaks it down. There's an art to this, and it's been fun to sort of study this from a distance with you and then up close.
Yeah, and in turn, I studied Paul, and then what you do is you adapt. You take the foundation, then you build around it.
Your style.
It's your design after that. You get the foundation he gives you, and then you create the house around it the way you want the house to look. And that's how we all kind of do it. But there's a foundational thing that I'll always be grateful to Paul James for. And, you know, peek behind the curtain here. When you host a two-hour sports talk show or you call a four-hour football game, that's all ad-libbed, right? I mean, we clearly have the ability to speak extemporaneously and go off the cuff. Ad-libbing is something we do for a living. But the things I can control and the things I can prepare, I do so to the utmost. And so the peek behind the curtain part here is even though I could easily ad-lib my half-hour pregame for a football game, my half-hour pregame for a basketball game, I could do that off the cuff with no problem.
Yes.
But I script everything word for word because I can, and it gives me the ability to present structure and content to the audience the exact way I design it. So when someone's listening, when they're driving into the Marriott Center, driving into the LaBelle Edwards Stadium, or listening to pregame one way or the other, and they hear Riley and me conversing in our pregame, or Mitchell and me, or whatever I'm putting out there, I'm working off a script. I'm not just throwing stuff out there. I'm working off a script, and a word-for-word written script, and ideally when the audience hears me, they hear it delivered in such a way that it sounds conversational, it sounds casual, and it sounds ad-libby in a way. But in reality, I've got my typed written pages in front of me, and I'm reading my script, but delivering it in a way that I'm able to do now after years of doing it that sounds ideally good to the audience. But I want Riley to know where I'm going. I want Mitch to know where I'm going. I want the audience to know where I'm going and have a design to what I do. And so I've always enjoyed that part of it. The scripting part is a chance to get down and write a mini book every game. Mm-hmm. You get to set up the chapter, you know, the preface for that night's game. You get to write the preface for every game you do.
Yeah.
You get to set it up the way you want. And I really enjoyed that. I love using words. I like wordplay. I like alliteration, as you know. There are certain devices that I tend to use more frequently than others, but I really do enjoy it. I mean, language to me is so much fun. I can be a stickler at times. For how it's used and how it's written, but I've taught myself to be that way. I wasn't as studied. I wasn't as learned in proper use of English for a long time. I wasn't a very good print style writer either for a long time until I taught myself how to do it. And I'm glad I did because I think the more I became concerned about how to write and speak or how to especially write better, I became a better speaker of it as well.
So I started doing Rugby on the Radio this year, and we had a little pregame thing, and I script that part.
Yeah, and not
you
everything.
Scripted.
Bullet points will suffice, and keywords will. You don't have to go word for. But I love having the structure part. I think it helps. And by the way, kudos to you because we talk about the sports. I call four main sports now, right? I call football, men's basketball, some women's basketball occasionally, women's soccer, baseball. Just recently started baseball, right?
Yeah, you just
baseball's a new one for me.
Yeah.
That's four sports, and they're pretty typical. But you call, you know, when you call volleyball and you call rugby, you call sports that are off. A little bit of the grid for traditional broadcasters.
Yeah.
I haven't done hockey. I'd be lost trying to do
That's
what you do.
That's the only thing I have over you, Greg.
No,
is I've done three hockey.
Yeah,
that's it.
So you've done sports. I haven't. I've done a couple color games on TV back in the day for the Grizzlies. But for the most part,
dang it,
you can't. Stepping in to do rugby, stepping in to do volleyball. These are the things you do that I haven't done, and most broadcasters couldn't just step in and do. And so, you know, a good friend of mine is Todd Harris. We were classmates at BYU back in the day. And Todd's – one of Todd's greatest gifts is his ability to call almost any sport you could imagine because he's done almost any sport you can imagine.
He's doing a ton of MMA. He's been done in the Olympics. World's Strongest Man
right.
was him,
you
his
know,
voice. Like,
I mean,
all that.
I mean, he can do surfing, sailing, skateboarding, all this kind of stuff that's just – most broadcasters don't have a chance. Todd's done it all.
You've probably heard Todd's voice without knowing
right.
it if you don't recognize
Todd. And, you know, we're – you know, the Olympics featured skateboarding this time. That was Todd Harris doing that. And those who don't, you know, Todd is a BYU guy. When you see Todd's face, you don't, you probably hear more than you see him, but when you see Todd, you'll know that's a BYU guy. Was trained how I was trained. We've been friends forever since we were classmates here at BYU. It's been so fun to watch him and his career just kind of explode. And he still lives in Utah, but he's a world, literally a world traveler. Be a sportscaster, see the world. That's Todd Harris.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, other people, and thank you, by the way. That was very nice. Other people who were in school with you, was Dave McCann with you?
We graduated the same day.
Jane Clayson?
Yeah.
Who else? That's pretty good, you and those three.
No, Dave and Todd and Jane. Those are some. Yeah, there are a lot of newscasters that bounce around and did different things. But of people I still associate with today that are in the sports realm, well, Dave McCann's an obvious one.
Yeah.
And Todd Harris. Those are kind of like the guys that I would still say I'm in most contact with these days. And we were all relatively at the same time there.
Is that the greatest era of BYU sports broadcaster students ever?
I mean, the one thing, Dave and I are still around doing what we hoped we'd do with BYU.
Yeah.
So there's that. There's something to be said for that. That's fun. Yeah.
When did you know or think, oh, I want to broadcast BYU specifically? When did that first start?
I think once I got in with Chris Tunis and started working at KSL, I realized first of all, how desired a location KSL is. Like KSL is still the gold standard of
50,000 watts.
So to me, you know, KSL was like, wow, like you've made it if you can stick there. And then because they had the BYU rights, getting involved with the BYU, you know, broadcast at that point, then, well, if you're in it, you want to stay in it. You know, BYU was my school, graduated there, you know, passion for it, and now I get to be their sideline guy and eventually a play-by-play guy. But once I got into it, I didn't want to leave it. You know, there are certain broadcasters you get in who want to climb the ladder, you know, step by step, market to market, ESPN, boom, that's your end destination. I was not that guy. I was the guy that thought, wow, if I could be associated with BYU sports, I want to stay associated with BYU sports. And so, I've been able to do it for, you know, again, 30 years now in one way or another. And I'm just I feel blessed to have been able to do it as long as I have.
At the beginning of this, did you think, oh, if I can, like you said, did you ever think, oh, maybe I'll go somewhere else? Or did you think, no, I'm going to be a lifer?
Well,
because it's hard too, because BYU has to want to keep you.
Right. And there has to be.
And they have. Of course.
And there has to be obviously a position that fits you or that you're qualified for that's open to you. Like, so when you're the sideline guy, as I was, I'm young. You know, I'm 22, 23 years old, whatever I was when I got the sideline
gig. You're so young when you get that.
Right. So I'm young, and Paul's toward the end of his career. So there's a gap there that makes sense that if you're going to train for that job, if you look at it as training, then timing-wise, it might work out if you're any good, right? But still, it's totally unpredictable. I mean, I didn't go into the sideline gig thinking I can be the next play-by-play guy. There are those who tell me that when I was at BYU as a student, I would tell them I want to be the voice of the Cougars someday.
Mm.
And I may have, but I don't remember that being a driving thing in my life, like Paul James or bust. That's not how I felt. I think I was just happy to be, you know, working at KSL, having this great sideline gig and learning from PJ. But I had no indication, you know, when Paul's time would come to an end. And I had no indication from KSL that I'd be the guy they would turn to. But what changed—
You're saying in 2000, 2001?
Yeah, early. No, I'm talking about in the mid-90s when I'm doing the sideline.
Yeah.
So from 92 through 2000 is when I'm Paul's sideline guy. I have no indication when it's going to come to an end for Paul. And I have no indication that I'm going to be his replacement. I'm just doing my job the best I can as a sideline guy.
Yeah.
I mean, my 20s, late 20s.
PJ, you're not thinking about the next step.
No, and to the contrary, Jerem, I mean, when you're the sideline guy, you walk the field on game day with the headset on, and Paul's in your ear the entire. You hear Paul James's broadcast and Mark's broadcast in your headset. You know, you're not a fan, but you're a listener. You're a really invested listener, but you're listening for how they do it. And I would constantly think, I could never do this. I could never do
really?
What Paul's doing. Oh, that was the prevailing thought.
Huh.
I thought, okay, I can handle sidelines. I can jump in every few minutes with something. That works. But call a play? Are you kidding me? It was too hard. I mean, because I'd watch the play in front of me from field level as I hear Paul call it, and I'm like, how did he just get all that information into those last 6 seconds?
Mm.
I'm still trying to catch up visually. And I remember thinking, wow, it'd be so cool to do what he does, but I could never do it. I couldn't do it.
Hmm.
It was just seemed too hard. The memorization alone. Like I'd be with Paul in his room when he'd do his memorization drills. I'm like, dude, how are you fitting 60 names and numbers in your brain to just recall at a moment's notice?
Memorization drills.
Yeah, they become my life.
What were those like?
I mean, I have mine now, but I mean, you'd help him memorize. You'd help him in the room, right?
What would that be like?
Well, he'd rattle off a number. He gives you a name.
Yeah.
You know, and a position, and so, but how he got to the point where they'd be locked in, I'm like, this is like mystical, magical. How do you do it? But over time, I trained myself to do the same thing, but this all just felt too big for me, and so you know, it was cool to think about being the next guy, but I had no, it wasn't really a real thing. So you're moving along that way, and what changes everything is when he had his heart issues during a game, no less.
96 Utah
game, football game. So we're in the winter, the fall winter of 1996. I've done sideline 92, 3, 4, 5. This is my fifth year on the sidelines. No play-by-play experience at all.
Oh, you hadn't done anything.
Zero. I'd never called
nothing
a game up.
Andy,
no. I'm the sideline guy because I'm working at KSL and the gig came open and I got it. But I'm training as I go.
But hey, you had done some PA.
I had done some PA. I can talk into a mic. But no play-by-play at all. And then the Utah game of 1996 up in Salt Lake City, Steve Sarkisian, I think he attempted 12 passes all day, and BYU just destroyed Utah that day, just ran the ball for 500 yards. It was crazy.
I was in the Utah student section cheering for BYU.
Oh, good. The last part's important. but it was the pregame of the Utah game that year up at Rice Eccles, the old Rice Stadium, and Paul has a heart episode, has a cardiac episode in the pregame. So much so that it required paramedics to come in and attend to him while he's on the air with the headset on.
And while he's on the air.
Oh, yeah. No. He's on the air and he's having issues.
Is he describing it as he
goes?
No.
No one knows what's going on.
Oh, my gosh.
Now, ESPN, I think, had the game that day. I think they actually made reference to it in the broadcast. They took a shot of Paul in the booth saying, you know, he's grinding through. This guy, he didn't feel well before the game, but he's, you know, staying till the end kind of thing. But so Paul had a heart episode in the pregame. Paramedics monitored him up. I mean, the things on his chest. I mean, this is all happening while he's doing the broadcast pregame. And essentially, they wanted him to leave the booth and go get treated right away because they could tell this is a significant episode. And Paul said, I'm not leaving. This is the BYU-Utah game.
And BYU's 12-1, by the way, going into this game.
Yeah. They lost the game early in the season.
One of the greatest teams in BYU history. He doesn't want to step out.
So he said, I'm going to stay. I feel better now. He took a couple pills. He felt he'd gotten through it kind of thing. And they basically
– understatement of the century.
Yeah, and I think he basically had to sign like a waiver saying, you know, I'm refusing medical advice here. I'm staying.
If you die, it's not our
fault. Yeah. So he does – and you know, he does the game.
Having
and during the pregame, I'm on the field, right? I've got the headset on. I've got the jetpack on. I'm doing my sideline gig, and the engineer tells me in my ear, the audience can't hear, but he tells me, you may need to come up. You may need to be ready. I go, ready for what? He goes, well, Paul's not feeling well. I'm like, well, you know, no way could I have called that game, right? There's just absolutely no way. Play-by-play prep.
You can't just jump in.
Play-by-play prep and sideline prep, not the same thing.
Had you ever had that thought previously, by the way, that maybe – you would have to call a game if something happened to PJ?
No.
Because he never missed a game.
No, he's PJ.
You've never missed a game.
So I haven't. No football games missed. That's right. So,
Except for the birth of your child. Oh, as a play-by-play.
Yeah.
Sideline, you missed one game.
My first bowl game in 92.
That's it.
Yeah. Because we had a –
Incredible run.
Yeah, because I didn't know I was a sideline guy yet. So we'd planned to have a baby in December of 92.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't have the gig yet. And so it's a good excuse. I didn't know I'd have the gig. So – but I missed that first bowl game as a sideline guy. So Paul has this thing happen to him. And turns out I don't need to go up. He does the game. And BYU wins. In fact, it's the last game that BYU's beaten Utah by more than a touchdown.
I hate that stat so much.
1996 we're talking about. It's been that long. So when BYU wins, it's a squeaker. When Utah wins, it could be a squeaker or a bit of a crazy game gets away from you. But you know, close games are more the rule than the exception. But that said,
just rush for 300-plus yards, you're good.
BYU ran for a ton. We didn't hardly BYU hardly threw the ball. Steve Sarkisian, great quarterback. I think he threw it 12 times.
I think
you can check that number.
Completed 12. Was it 12? 7 of 12.
Yeah. I think he threw it 12 times total. Anyway, just all running.
Silly.
Anyway, great game. And maybe for Paul's benefit, it wasn't dramatic. It was a pretty. It was. Not sure he could have survived. Literally a nail biter.
Or 2000 up there.
So we do the game. Blowout. Great. Happy times. I go home. He goes home. No, he goes to the hospital. I go home. He goes to the hospital like they told him to. And I remember I'm at home after the game. He calls me from the hospital bed and says, I'm having 6 bypasses that I need surgery. You need to be in Seattle on Tuesday night for a basketball game. So that was it. That's how it started. Paul James has to have surgery. He's on the sidelines for a month or 5 weeks. And the next assignment he had was a BYU-Washington basketball game up in Seattle Tuesday. The game was Saturday. His surgery was Sunday or Monday, and then the game was Tuesday. Well, now he says you're going to go on a plane and go. I guess he probably told KSL, they probably talked and said, who can do it? And he probably said, well, Greg's right here. He knows a little bit about how to do this. Let's send him. And so for whatever reason, Paul, the station get together, trust me, and that starts my play-by-play career.
You've had nothing to do with basketball before, right?
No, I hadn't called a game. I hadn't called anything of any kind, mind you.
And that is amazing that your first play-by-play gig is KSO Radio, men's hoops.
Yeah.
Right into it.
It's one of the first games of the 1996-97 season, a season in which they won one game.
Season.
They went 1-25.
Yes.
I got the one win, by the way. Paul didn't get to call a win that year.
Sorry, Aggies.
At the Marriott Center. So that Tuesday night in Seattle, I went and called the game, and BYU lost by like 50-odd points.
It was bad.
Yeah.
How was that for your first game?
Was it maybe 95-44, something like that? Maybe lost by 51 points, something like that. My first game was literally a 50-point blowout. 1996-97 season, BYU at Washington. I think they lost 95-44. I think it was 51 points. I got to use Paul Ruffner, Paul James's color guy, and that was my first game.
And that was the first game. 95-44.
Yeah, there it is. 51 points. So the first game I ever called was a 51-point loss. And things didn't get a whole lot better that year. And again, But that was my introduction to play-by-play, was calling a 51-point loss and then being with a team that won one game. But I don't remember feeling crushed by the 51 points. I remember being exhilarated that I made it through.
Mm-hmm.
Like I felt like, I just did that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not rocket science, but you've never done it before. It's, you're talking to an audience that still cares about BYU and you're not Paul James. How does it all come together? I'm so glad that it happened in the non-social media era. Like if Twitter had been waiting to see how I do, replacing Paul James, I would have been probably more than I could handle. But as it was, I felt like I made it through. I got through, And
It wasn't my first play-by-play was BYU softball on the internet in front of 7 people.
Probably. Yeah, this is
what I mean? Like,
yeah, no.
No one was watching.
Knew this was going to be a 1-25 year yet. They just knew this was going to be a newish team for Roger. And then Roger soon got let go and then new coach. It was such a wild, weird year to be introduced to play-by-play.
Yes.
And then when Paul came back, we made a bargain. He bargained with me, rather, that he said he would do the home basketball games and I'd finish off the season on the road. So for the first month or 2 months of the season, I did everything. Then when Paul came back, we split home and road. But in the interim, I got the one football game. And that's a different deal too. Basketball is one thing. Football is a different deal. And I got the WAC championship game of 1996, BYU and Wyoming in Las Vegas. That was the one football game Paul had to miss due to the heart surgery. So I called that game, and it's an overtime win, and my voice went even higher than it normally does, but that was a whole new experience too. Was calling a football game, you're not Paul James. How do you do Paul's job?
Are you sweating in nervousness? Super nervous.
Yeah, I mean, these days I don't get nerves, right? I don't feel that, but I remember those first games. Super nervous.
Holy
you just feel like
cow.
Every people's hang, you feel like everyone's hanging on your every word and you can't make a mistake. And then when you get to a football game, you're not PJ. PJ is PJ. He's got a great booming melodic, rhythmic, poetic voice, and gold standard for me, and I'm just me, And so I was grateful to get that shot to try and call a football game. The fact that it went to overtime, and I think that helped people kind of enjoy it too, the fact that it was so dramatic and they weren't so focused on my performance. It was like, what a great game. And I got to be right with him. What a great game I got to call. And then Paul came back, did the Cotton Bowl. He got back in time for the Cotton Bowl. Then that was no gimme too. He got back in time for the Cotton Bowl win over Kansas State.
Yeah, it's only like 4 weeks later.
Yeah, and I was back on sidelines, but Paul was back in the booth. And that was fun too, to have him make it back and have everyone so glad that he made it. And then when that season ended, he stayed doing football only and gave me basketball. I say gave me basketball. And so those next few years, 97 to 2000, when I was doing basketball, he was doing football. Those were huge transition years for me. That's when I learned how to do play-by-play. So that when Paul left in 2000 with Lavelle and quit everything, football and basketball, I think it made it easier for KSL to look at me and say, that's our guy.
He's ready.
If Paul
you
hadn't
needed
got,
hoops,
yeah,
maybe.
If Paul hadn't gotten sick, let's say Paul has perfect health through the year 2000 and then he retires with Lavelle. Well, I might have had a shot, but it just was likely that KSL would have said nationwide search, let's see what happens. And I don't get the gig. Because I would have had no play-by-play experience. I would have had no experience, right? So those transition years, the football game I got, the basketball games I got, that I think helped make decisions that put me, you know, as an option for Paul when he retired. If that didn't happen, I may not have the gig at all. So, you know, it takes an event or a circumstance of misfortune to result in someone's good fortune in this case. And it goes back to the adage too, you know, what's luck? It's preparation meeting opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in a way I'd prepared learning under Paul, then the opportunity comes in a weird way, and that's luck for Greg. He gets a chance to try his hand out at play-by-play.
Third person reference, that's a yellow card.
So by those years of preparation as a play-by-play guy, it then makes it a more simple decision maybe in the year 2000 when in reality they might have just gone somewhere else altogether.
Thank you, Conan O'Brien.
Yeah. Year 2000. Glad you got that. I'm sure like four other people got that.
Trent, did you get that? Nope. Okay.
So back when we started this conversation 4 hours ago, I mentioned Danny Gallivan and Dick Irvin, the voices of Hockey Night in Canada.
Yes.
And
Danny
Gallivan gets his break when an announcer got sick and he filled in. I mean, that's kind of you find this all the time where that's how it happens. It's unforeseen, and that's why it's hard when people ask for advice. You know, what should I do to be in your position? I go, I have
a rich dad.
In some way, I don't know because I don't know how I got to this position.
Yeah,
it's nothing I could have planned for, prepared for. You hope to have some preparation, but so many times it's an uncertain thing, and you know, and a lot of it's timing too.
100%. When you say opportunity, I thought, it's.
Again, I was really young, and Paul was toward the end, so there was a timing thing that benefited me. You know, if Paul James was in his early 40s when I got the sideline gig, it's a totally different situation. I'm not doing this now, so it's that's how it is.
Yes, and for those who don't know, I have the same ambition. Like whenever you're done, I'm hoping I have a shot at being the guy. I'll probably be 50.
There's a lot of pressure. See, I feel bad every year I start another year.
No,
I'm like, it's another year that Jeremy can't do this.
No, get out of here. I'm doing everything around it that I can until it's available when I'm 50 and you're maybe
don't
done.
Don't say it.
Maybe
not,
done.
Let's not talk.
And then
numbers.
I can do it for 15 years and then I'm done, you know? But no, that's incredible. Do you have like a favorite game or call of yours that was like, oh, that's the one that I really cherish or anything like that?
Calls, no. I just feel like there are too many flaws and too many of the calls to really embrace them.
You can't enjoy that?
Yeah. I tend to be a little too critical about the calls themselves because they never quite match the play in my mind. Like the play is always way better than the call.
The fans feel otherwise.
Yeah.
Because the call is attached to the play.
So there's the only saving grace, right, is you have to remove yourself from it and say, okay, appreciate the fact that the fans appreciate the call.
Yes.
Right? Then that helps you.
Yeah.
But if I just want to look at the call objectively, I find way too many things wrong with them. So then it comes down to the play and the game and how much I love that part of it. So yeah, you know.
Do you have a couple that stick out?
Well, Bechtehaar, you know, it's kind of cliche, but
Bechtehaar is the greatest moment that you've called.
Tough to find bigger ones, right? I mean, if you're not playing for a national championship or in a New Year's Day bowl. Like we call New Year's Day bowls now, not to discredit the Cotton Bowl of 96, 97 at all. I'm just saying, unless you're playing in those situations, then, you know, what could be better than beating your rival on your rival's home field on the final play of the game with zeros on the clock? I mean, that's like the dream scenario. Or any great Hail Mary like at Nebraska or Boise State, those kinds of things. Those are tough to beat because of what's on the line for what's on the line. And it's not the biggest stakes, but there are big stakes. And the fact that, you know, a whole building can shake and reverberate with cheers and emotion. Those are special, special moments. And everything Jimmer did that year, right, the special games he had to be a part of that, I found myself getting so carried away and so wrapped up in what he was doing. Those were the moments when I became, you know, not purely a fan, but I had the fans' energy and the fans' incredulity and the fans' amazement at what this guy was doing. I was having so much fun calling Jimmer's games and shots because I was right with every fan going, this is insane. But you have the responsibility to describe it a certain way, but you lose yourself in the moment at times. I found myself doing that a lot. But and again, in the biggest, biggest moments, you tend to lose, at least I tend to lose a bit of control of my vocal faculties, and you think you've got a handle on it, and then you don't, and it gets a little crazy. But again, the fans tend to forgive you a little bit.
It's pretty endearing, though.
Yeah,
because you're reacting like the fans to a degree.
Yeah, but you think this many years in the business, you've trained your voice as an instrument. And when you feel it break or kind of get away on you, you're like, how did that just happen? You know, how am I this far into my career and that still happens? But it happens in those moments where everyone's kind of doing the same thing, right?
Yes.
You're all kind of together in the fact that you're screaming your heads off.
You're the only one that can be heard in that medium, and your emotion comes through your voice. It's
And that's the thing,
moment.
Too, is and no one plans for those moments.
Any time
that I've gotten really loose with it and it gets kind of crazy, you know, I would never have intended that. It just happens. It's a byproduct of the excitement.
There's no voice crack on terrible plays. It's just the great one.
Again, I've called a lot of plays that totally by the book. Nothing crazy happens, but the wildest ones tend to bring that out in me. And it happens.
Okay, tell me about this. You might be the classiest dresser of all radio guys in the country.
Well, no.
You dress up
I have dressed up. I mean, now keep in mind, for basketball games. Football, I tend to do football. I'm in a polo with khakis.
I take it all back.
Soccer. No. For football, it's been more the uniform. And I will
match
say, no.
Staff.
Back in the day, back in the KSL days, I was shirt and tie for football and basketball. But when I got in at BYU, I was more like the uniform of the coach, if you will, polo and khakis.
Yeah.
Basketball, until last season with COVID, I was always a suit or shirt and tie. Dressy uppie.
Yes.
Soccer more casual, baseball more casual. But basketball was a different thing. It was kind of like I dressed like a coach, if you will. And so last
year,
why
the dressy uppie?
I don't know. I just felt like it was. I don't know if the coach was going to look like that. I felt like I should look like that. I just kind of took my cues that way, and I felt a lot of guys did it, and I felt it kind of showed a dedication to the professionalism of it that you dress up a little bit. Then COVID came and we all kind of dressed down, and that might be a remnant. That might stay with us. I don't know. But I think nowadays I could be a little less stringent with the dress code and feel okay about things, but I still want to look professional.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was kind of my thing. I did do a lot of shirt and tie stuff.
I ask you this very often, how much to do X? So like how much to wear flip-flops to a men's basketball game next year? How much could I pay you?
And by the way, and money has never changed hands with these propositions.
You've never actually accepted one of my – how much to say this? Yeah. If I paid you $500, would you wear flip-flops to a men's basketball game?
Slides with socks. I would do that.
With socks
guy?
Yeah,
yeah. Well, no, I have to. I can't go purely barefoot to a basketball game.
Oh, you can't?
No, I couldn't do that.
Okay, so some
measure of decorum.
Without socks, $500, would you do it?
Slides with dress socks, yeah. Oh, some classy slides. So like black, some like Nike black slides with black dress socks. It makes it look like I'm regular shoes. Yeah.
Like a regular Joe.
Yeah, I've never taken Jerem's dares, by the way.
Okay, you, so off the, out of the booth, away from the mic, you like to run. You when you go on the road, you're in the WCC at Malibu or whatever, you're taking pics. Hey, went on.
Yeah, I run.
What kind of runner are you? How much do you run?
I run a half marathon a year every summer just to train for something. I'm running a 10K as well this summer with my daughter because she asked me to on the spur of the moment. So I'm going to run a race or two every summer.
That's awesome.
And I do it as a health maintenance thing. I find that during the fall and winter, when you're on the road the whole season, you eat a lot away from home, a lot of restaurants and whatnot. You tend to put on more pounds. It's colder. You're more sedentary. So in the spring and summer, then I try to lose those pounds and I do it by running. So yeah, I like running. But there are days when you don't like running and it takes you a mile until you start liking to run again sometimes. But it keeps me fit. I think I'm still decently fit. I can still stand to lose 10 to 15 pounds at any point in the year, I feel like. But I do run frequently. I'm not fast, but I'm fast enough. I'm still knocking my half marathons out in, 150 or less usually. So,
nice.
I'm not that slow yet. So
you don't really eat lunch.
I'm not a big lunch guy.
I invite you to lunch often. You politely say no.
I say no all the time. Yeah. Not a big lunch guy. Not a big breakfast guy or lunch guy. I'm a snacker.
You just don't really eat.
I'm a snacker and a dinner guy.
You're a snacker and a dinner guy.
Believe me, I still gain enough weight. I'm not like starving myself. I gain enough weight. I just do it in really bad ways with snacks and soda and big meals at dinner time.
Do you go to the same restaurants in the same road cities of men's basketball games?
Yeah, I'm kind of a creature. I'm not very exciting.
No, so I know you love Outback Steakhouse.
Yes,
I've been to Outback with you.
Yes, I do. I've got my items. There are certain things.
What is it? Bushman
Shrooms. The Bushman Shrooms. Now, sometimes like they're now called the Sydney Shrooms, and sometimes they're not even on the menu. But if if they're not on the menu, ask for them anyway. They'll make them for you.
I felt special.
I found that out.
Yes. I felt special when I was with you.
In fact, I think the reason they returned to the menu is because I kept asking for them in all these cities that it went off the menu.
In like nine cities, they've asked for it. No, it's the same guy.
So, yeah, there are a lot of broadcasters, and I there are guys on Twitter that have 18 awesome restaurants for every city, and they're all, you know, hole in the wall,
and
under the radar.
The baseball guys.
Right. So there are guys that know all the best, coolest, no one knows about places
Triple
to go.
D.
And I'm the guy that goes, no, Outback. You know, so I like what I like, and I get what I get, and I do have my regulars. Yeah. Not that I won't go off the beaten path, but right. I can't give you great off the beaten path places. I just tend to kind of stick close to the norm.
Where do you go in Spokane?
Spokane, I go to the Onion.
The Onion?
The Onion downtown.
We went to, after BYU won its first game in Spokane.
Or the Outback.
We went up there.
The Outback.
I don't even remember where we were, but I ate dinner with you and Mark after BYU beat Gonzaga for the first time. What, 2014?
Yeah, that could have been the steakhouse in the hotel,
I think. That's one of the best steaks I had ever had in my life.
Yeah, no, it was
It was incredible.
It was in the old Doubletree in Spokane.
Gotcha.
It might have been Spencer's. Spencer sound right?
Linton's, yeah.
No, there are some things that are just because a matter of convenience. If there's a good steakhouse in the hotel, I'll go there.
Nice.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, clearly we love the Ruth's Chris's of the world and things like that.
Yeah.
But
Not too exciting. Are you a superstitious broadcaster?
I tend to lean away from superstition because I honestly do believe that jinxes don't exist. So I don't want to, because you can't talk out of both sides of your mouth. You can't say jinxes don't exist, but I have to wear this.
and I won't mention this free throw streak.
So I don't have superstitions as much as I have routine. I think I have a lot of routines.
And poutine.
I love the poutine. By the way, I never knew it was called poutine until I came down here. Like up in Canada, chips and gravy.
Chips and gravy. Okay.
Yeah, because chips are fries. Anyway.
Yeah.
So chips and gravy. So I probably had more French fries with gravy than I had ketchup growing up.
That's a Canadian thing.
Yeah. So, but I digress. So I have routines that bring me comfort in getting ready for a game. So those things aren't truly superstitious as much as they put me in a good place. You drive a certain route or you leave at a certain time.
You're saying these are things?
And you do, or you do things at certain times of your day.
Yes.
So I have routines, but I wouldn't call them superstitions as much as they just kind of put me in a comfort zone to call a game well.
How early – let's talk football because it's longer. When do you – okay, when do you – it's a 8:26 kickoff. When do you leave your house? When do you get to the stadium? When are you on the air? When are you going home? Because this is like a long day for you.
Yeah, I tend to go 3 hours before kick to leave.
Yeah. So you're leaving at 5:30.
Or 3.5, depending on quarter past or what have you.
Yeah.
But I want to give myself at least – it'll be 3+ hours when I leave the house. Because we're going to be on the air 2 hours before. And then my personal part comes a little bit later than that. So I give myself enough advance time.
And you start what? Is it an hour before, 30 minutes before?
Well, I'll interview Kalani an hour before. So I need to make sure I'm in position for that.
Before you're on the air.
Yeah. No, I'll interview Kalani 90 minutes before. Then I do a brief hit an hour before, and then I do my full pregame show half hour before. So I need to be in position with Kalani 90 minutes before kick.
Average
for our pregame
game
interview.
Is 3.5 hours.
Yeah.
So when the game ends, you've been engaged.
Oh, day long.
All day, but like 5 hours from when you interviewed Kalani. Plus you do like a 2 hour postgame
show.
Yeah,
right.
7 hours.
I look at a game day as an 8 hour production. Like, and our broadcast
it's like
a
full day of work for the average
person. Our broadcast will last 7 to 8 hours. And I'll get there before and stay after. So it's 10 hours, you know, by the time you've taken all that in. And then you're going to, you know, if there's time, you'll go find a meal and eat with your guys. And so it's a day-long thing.
That's a long time.
Yeah. And in
Are
this,
you exhausted?
And in this, oh, yeah.
By the,
in,
just the, like
in this business, you know, it's never been a 5-day-a-week gig. It's a 6- and 7-day-a-week gig.
Yeah.
But that's why you get into it for that. Like no one complains about the fact that, every Saturday is a game day. No, that's why you're in this thing. But a traditional get to Friday, hey, it's the weekend. That doesn't exist from August through March.
Yes.
Or not from August through April into May. Now it's baseball. So from August through May.
You keep adding things.
Yeah, so from August through May, Saturday is never, hey, it's always a game day. Every Saturday is a game day. So your Fridays are just prepping for games, not, oh, the weekend's here. But again, no complaints. That's why we do this. But it's one of those things that becomes your life.
doing a post-game show of that length, and in basketball even, in some remote spots where they're trying to clean up or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
You've had all kinds of situations. Any stick out in terms of chairs banging, power going out, lights shutting off?
Yeah, well, we've been asked to leave venues before, and we try and reason with them. No, we have an audience that's with us here for another 45 minutes to an hour. Like, we can't leave. We're on the air. You get to a lot of schools where their crews do 5 minutes of postgame, and they're done, and they think everyone else should be the same way. So we were at venues last year, especially with COVID. They were really more sensitive with COVID last year. They wanted you in and out in a hurry, and we're not really a hurry show. We're kind of a take-your-time kind of show, and it's a longer broadcast. So you have people that want you to leave. You've had people that mistakenly, sometimes I'll say one or two times it's been intentional, turn the power off on you or unplug you. That's happened before. That happens. So I'll say once or twice a year for basketball, someone – or for soccer, someone's going to unplug you.
Oh, wow.
Just because they'll be breaking stuff down. They're just yanking stuff, and someone yanks something that has you on the air.
Yep.
And it's usually 99% unintentional, like, uh-oh, you know, what just happened? Oh, sorry, we'll fix it. But yeah, the cleanup crews, there are certain stadiums we've talked about, War Memorial Gymnasium in San Francisco, where they want to put the seats down after the game. These rows
of
seats.
We're now talking to Margo.
Yeah, rows of seats go slamming down for the next 20 minutes, and you hear that. So those kind of things happen, and you occasionally have, you know, phone lines that die in the old days, gear that's, you know, got, you know, or, I mean, going, remember the Jackson Emery Jimmer Fredette game at UNLV where Jimmer shot from the logo and that game?
Yep.
That game I did on Russian-era Soviet-style headsets that were borrowed from a station in Las Vegas because someone took my broadcast gear off the carousel at McCarran.
Oh!
Yeah. Delta sent us to the wrong baggage carousel, so I was waiting at the wrong carousel. My gear ended up at another carousel, and someone was pulling off Pelican cases just by the dozen, and mine looked like someone else's, and it got taken. I didn't see it again for 2 weeks. And so I had a game the next night, that UNLV-BYU game. I did it with borrowed gear. And again, it was the worst gear you could buy. It was like pulled out of a garage sale type stuff.
Morse code during.
It was hard. Yeah, so you have things like that happen. And then literally, the crew that pulled my gear kept it for 10 days. And then when they left Vegas, they were there for the Consumer Electronics Company. They just returned it to Delta, saying we had this extra case, and Delta tracked it to me and got it back to me. But I was doing 2 weeks with extra gear for that reason. So that kind of stuff happens. So that way, I mean, now when I travel for basketball and soccer and baseball with my broadcast case, like I have to leave my site to get checked on the airplane, but I like camp myself at the bottom of the conveyor belt. Like I want to be the first guy to see every piece of luggage come off because I'm never having that happen again. I'm manic about that. I have to get my hands on my gear ASAP because, I mean, I've had people take it.
If you got to the end of this, which there's going to be people, tweet at me and tell me.
No,
tell me the following – just tweet at me the following word, muskrat.
No.
Muskrat. And then I'll know.
No one's going to get there.
Muskrat.
No, this
just
is
tweet
us.
At me, at Jerem Jordan, at Gregor Bell, muskrat. Then we'll know.
This is us just chatting for
Greg,
each other.
This was awesome. I'm serious. We'll have to do this another time because my wife's probably like, where are you? But anyway, thanks so much for sitting down with me and chatting here. And I know that you mean a ton to BYU fans. They love Gregor Bell, the voice of the Cougars. It's been so fun for me to work with you these past several years and have you write me letters of recommendation and just be so nice to me. Now it's fun to like be your colleague.
Yeah, no, I'm
as a broadcaster. That's really fun for me.
I'm beyond blessed to have this job. I know how fortunate I am, and I'm blessed to work with you, be your friend, and have our close relationship as well. And maybe we'll do this again. Maybe there'll be more.
We're doing it again. And quick story before we end. So I marry Whitney in 2011, and I invite you to my reception, and you come to my reception.
Yeah, I did.
You sit down at a table.
Yeah.
And my uncle Chris and my uncle Connell are there, and they are like buzzed with excitement because the voice of the Cougar just sat down at their table and they chat with you and you couldn't have been nicer. And so
I couldn't have missed
that. Was like one of the highlights of their lives.
Oh,
they love
please.
It. They're like, Greg, Greg. And every time a season ends, my uncle Craig texts me, he goes, Greg just signed off the end of football, and a little tear came down my face like it does every year this time that it's over.
I joked at the beginning of this conversation, again, hours ago, that I work for you. And that's, of course, in reference to the fact that for the last few seasons here at BYU Broadcasting, you were running the coaches show, that I host.
Yeah.
So, you know, as the showrunner, you got to, you know, lay out your vision and hopefully have me execute it. So I've been fortunate to work with you that way and learn from you and your crew and hopefully do a good enough job for you and the audience. So it's been fun to again, kind of have it come full circle and work with you that way. And again, your role will change this year. Your fingerprints are still all over the coaches' shows, and hopefully we'll do a good job for you this season.
Thank you. I had enough, so I'm done. just kidding.
Forced you out.
Yeah. I'm enough. No, Greg, yeah. This was awesome. We will do part two in the future. I don't know when, but we're going to do it because I have a million other questions.
Give the audience a break for a while. Let them just fully digest all this.
At Jerem Jordan, at Greg Rubel, muskrat. That'll do it for us. Thanks for listening to this episode. You can always download episodes on demand. BYU Radio app where podcasts are found. For Greg Rubel, I am Jerem Jordan. You've just listened to Deep Blue on BYU Radio.